very excited to have Ellen Wilkin here. She met Dan Duffy while he was on vacation. Was it when you were writing?
Yeah, I was out
when
in
he
Albuquerque.
Was traveling.
I'm sorry, we started in Albuquerque. We ended up in Boulder.
Yeah, so Dan Duffy, who was on the board at the Writers Center, was traveling, working on his own book, and met Ellen Wilkin and came back and said, "We have to bring her here." So we're happy that you're here. Very excited to have Ellen Wilkin here. Ellen Wilkin has been writing for 45 years as a poet and essayist, as a technical writer and editor in the computer industry, and as a novelist. Several of her poems were published in the Poetry Jam Sessions, a collection she also edited. Her current project is a science fiction time travel novel. She also runs a poetry salon in Longmont, Colorado. Ellen.
Thank you, Amanda. I want to thank also Henry and Dan for letting me know that this is even exists and for encouraging me to apply for this Writers in Residence program, and I've really enjoyed it. I have been writing furiously while I've been here, and I whipped up a few poems this morning and I thought I'd share them with you. Just kidding. But I would like to share a couple poems that I did write since I've been here, and then perhaps move on to some other pieces. This piece is called Working Writer. What can I say about the gull twisting in the wind as it fights a stiff breeze off the ocean, and the bright pebbles below on the sea-weeded sand, staring up at him, and up at the sky beyond, like a thousand bubbly eyes, sightless, but rounded in the experience of thundering sound and the gritty wash of waves.
Sounds like Glasta.
That's what Glasta is to me. Ooh, there's a bit of glare on my screen here. Hold on. Okay. This is called Quick and Easy. I hear through my open window the crinkle of thin plastic. A man in a baseball hat stands under a sign that reads, "It's quick, it's easy." He is tossing out an empty Cape Cod kettle chip bag 25 feet from the Golf Mini Mart, where he purchased it a moment ago. He misses the garbage can by several inches. As he saunters back to his car, a sanitation truck pulls up. Two men leap out wearing reflective vests, skin reddened by wind and sun. They grab the bins and cans with gloved hands and pour the waste of the neighborhood into the back of the truck. Tossing the bins onto the ground, they hop up back on, just as the driver jams back into gear, and with a man hanging off each corner, the truck disappears around the bend of East Main. Back in the mini mart, the chip bag blows, quick, across the parking lot, unbinned, unleashed to the wind, to the sea, to everlasting time. Easy.
Nice.
I have to poke at the right place on my screen to get the right Sometimes it takes a while. This poem is called Golden Light, and it's kind of connects up with what Amanda was talking about, the writing in the plein air, ironically. At end of day at Rocky Neck, the sun beams off the glass face of a picture window on the hill across the bay, sending a flash stream of ripples toward me. White hulls of sailboats sat primly in the calm of evening on water clouds and sea sun. A red shack on the pier, freshly painted by Sam with fisherman artist impressions and adorned with figures of crab and lobster, is a lively catch. I've come to paint, too. With my pen dripping, I smear on the canvas the dark figures of women huddled on the hillside, pointing out to the sea, and wondering if that tiny dot, a light dip of the pen and then a quick stab at the canvas, is their husband or brother or father or son, late returning for dinner, or perhaps from weeks at sea, their quiet waiting, a soft hush of gray oils. And now, I'm plunging my pen deep into my palette, and placing thick yellow and black beasts careening through the stillness of the bay. They leave behind a disturbance in the water, which I develop with gray, white, and blue lines of paint, sliced through with a knife. Now for something completely different. this is a poem I wrote as part about a year and a half ago, in a kind of a coming together of separate events. Shortly after I had met Dan, and Dan had told me about the writer in residence program and about the Gloucester Writer Center, I was approached by a friend of mine who is a painter. And she asked me to join her in a collaboration, which is happens every year in the Denver area, Denver, Colorado area, where a wordsmith meets up with someone who works in paint or materials of some kind, and they collaborate on a piece. So we did get together, and we talked about common values and ideas, and started talking about how artists, an idea of art and creation, people get labeled as, you're a writer, you're a painter, you're a sculptor, you're a musician, you're not a singer, you know, things like that. And that idea of self, being able to fully express oneself is so important. And then I watched Henry Farini's film, at least a brief part of it that's on YouTube, about Vincent Farini, and knowing that I was coming here to stay in his home. And things just kind of gelled. So I wrote this poem, and it comes with the piece, which Julie, my artist collaborator, painted after reading my poem. So it was kind of like a collaboration, but at the same time, she didn't begin to paint until after she had read my poem. So I'm going to pass this painting around.
Are you actually staying in this house?
I am.
You are?
Yeah.
Oh, right. Wow. Did they show pictures of it before it was renovated and transposed? And...
I don't believe I've seen pictures of that, no.
Is that a type of pointillism?
It is. Thank you, Dan. It is a pointillist style. That's her preferred style. And it's called, the painting is called The Bark of the Cottonwood. And it was an old cottonwood tree that had been struck by lightning, and it was cut in a big cottonwood tree, so the stump was huge. And she just took a photograph looking down at the stump and then painted it afterward. So, but anyway, the collaboration happened at a good time for me, and so I wanted to share this with you all, because it also had something to do with the Gloucester Writer Center.
Thank you.
Thank you. The poem, I Am Art, in memory of Vincent Farini. I am art, my living, this process, this body of work, the walk on mud-lined paths under cottonwoods and among willows armed and embracing, the waking after dreams escaping, the dawn drenched in heart-wrenching color that has no name, the drafting of words upon words upon words, and the light from the window prancing across the page that evokes the sleep, the resting on comfortable beds, the redressing of wounds from reckless seething battle, the soft light of the moon not even stirring the dark corner where I lie, but inventing story the whole while. The voyage beyond the tiny yard and house, the pushing off from shore, the dark clouds and the rain pouring into a leaky boat. The new land with lampposts for trees, ancient marble and stone for grass under my feet. The bright umbrella is chasing away gray and the map to home lying in among tourist souvenirs stored in a tray. So how are you guys feeling? Are you feeling like something serious, something light, something?
One of each.
One of each, okay.
Or at least one of each.
Did you do any that you like from the train ride? Because I'd love to hear if you have anything on that.
Interesting.
I have written things based on trains, but I don't think I have anything with me.
This trip, you didn't do anything on it?
Yeah, I have a love-hate relationship with riding on trains. It's in some ways it seems natural, and in other ways it's just kind of the hecticness of travel. It just, you know, just depends. okay. This is a poem I wrote about a month ago for our poetry salon. Back in Boulder, Colorado. Driving, 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 keep driving. Try to outrun the pain, the war, the blood, the women and children machine gunned down, blood oozing from a thousand wounds. No way to stench it now. The red trails seeping into the muddy ground of the jungle, the rust-colored spatters on the fronds. It was a split second between the order and the execution. It was a split second between word and deed. Could have said no, could have dropped the gun, could have run away and gotten lost in the undergrowth. But the stern face of the master sergeant, his mouth snarling the words, masked all doubt. If he disobeyed, he was not a man. He could not come home again. He would never find himself again, not after. The children and their mothers, dead-eyed and flesh-torn, followed him everywhere. No matter how many long hauls he takes away from his own wife and children, away from his shame, no matter how late into the night he drives, at some point he has to close his eyes. And then the bodies flop onto the ground again in the narrow lane that was their village center and fall among the fronds and under the gnarled trees. But now their cold, clammy hands reach for him, grasping his legs, then his arms, and finally circle his throat and squeeze. And then he wakes with a jerk, lights a cigar, pulls back on the highway to put in another 50 miles before dawn, just as far as Dansville, where he hits the truck stop, where he orders coffee, eggs, and dry toast, and flirts with the blonde waitress. Soon he climbs back into the cab and pulls his rig back on the highway. The part they didn't say, his father, the Marine recruiter, is even when you do your duty, you're lost anyway. Nobody wants you once you've killed innocents, least of all yourself.
Is that the light one?
Yeah, that was so light it was heavy.
If you can handle that, then you can really handle this next one.
What's Dave thinking about that? Oh,
yeah, I've heard it before. It's a good one.
Yeah,
I've got to say hi, internets. yeah, okay. So this is kind of a nostalgic one. Happier than that. The field car. Flattened wild grasses flash beneath me as I hold on to the seat in front, my feet spaced widely on either side of the hole. The Volkswagen engine roars as my father lets out the clutch, and we careen over the mounds, joyously bumping through old farmer's furrows, long since left fallow. Is the farmer looking over his shoulder? Can he see us flattening the flax and the thistle and the chicory that will now shrug at his plow? Does he care that his field is being defaced by a ferocious beetle? My heart flips at the thought that he just might might pull my father aside and in a quiet adult dignity say, so, and therefore, and we would never again run over the high green stacks of that abandoned field, that meadow of delight, a sea of butterflies that saunter away from the windows, giving room to that large beetle in flight, my brothers, my sister, my dad, and me, in a rusted out red 64 bug. It's one of my personal favorites.
You used to have a blue copy of me, bug.
What year? Was it a super beetle?
63.
Oh, okay.
Old one.
Yeah, that's an old one. He had the 64, 69, both red, and then 73 was a super beetle in blue.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah, that one was his last beetle. They all kind of fell apart around it, slowly.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Trying to decide what's a good follow-up here. Anything about that? Well, yes, in fact, here's one that will do nicely.
I thought so. I knew it.
This poem I wrote last month for our poetry jam. It's called Calling Inspiration. And there's a picture that goes with it too, but it's just one I pulled from the internet, so I like to put photos with my posts. A red dress. Okay. Sure. I saw you down the street. I caught a glimpse of your red hair, the glint in your eye. Then you were swallowed up in the crowd and you were gone. Something about the texture of layered limestone on a bed of red sand in Ojo Caliente sends a jolt through me. But the moment passes like an electric field through me, but neglects to burn the equivalent language into my brain. I caught the edge of your red silk dress just then and felt the soft weave. I hung on as you danced over the water and soared over the mountain peaks. But at 10,000 feet, I lost my grip, and now I am 10,000 feet down. Where was it to the rest of that flight? Can I take the next plane and catch you up? Apparently all flights are full, and I must sag back down to the ground in this nameless spot in which I have landed.
Oh, Caliente, is that in Albuquerque?
It's near Santa Fe.
Near Santa Fe?
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Yeah.
It's a suitcase.
Yeah.
It's a
suitcase, yeah, that's Mexico. Near Santa Fe.
I'm sorry, not familiar with the term.
It's just another town.
They're all in the Rio Grande Rift.
Right, okay. I figured I should know the name. Okay, well, here's a humorous one. Until someone tells me to back off on the humor. Is anyone here familiar with Dr. Seuss?
Yeah.
Are you familiar with a story, a poem, in one of his books called Too Many Daves?
No.
It begins, did I ever tell you that Mrs. McCabe had 23 sons and she named them all Dave? Okay. So, it's also a picture with this, but you can't possibly see from back there. But
23 sons, you all named them Dave?
Yeah.
It's a Dr. Seuss poem or your poem?
That's a Dr. Seuss poem. This, in response to Dr. Seuss's Too Many Daves, and to all the times that Dave is the name of the villain of the piece, whether in a movie or a TV show or a memoir or novel, and for my husband, Dave, who is bloody well sick of it. Okay.
Is that true, Dave?
Oh, yeah.
He's bloody well sick.
Have I told you about my husband, Dave? He wasn't the 23rd son of Mrs. McCabe. The fact is, he was born alone of Dave kind, the youngest of three, and I am sure you will find he's unique. One of a kind, not ubiquitous. And he's, despite his name, that I make a fuss. He is true beyond what a name can endow. It is his brilliance, kindness, wisdom, and know-how. Not having a name like Dave that gives him perks. For why else are there Daves who are outright jerks? It's the true Daves who should lay claim to the name, not some cur who deserves nothing but all the blame. True Daves could have been called any name at all, be it Harvey or Corey or Jim or Paul. It would not matter a bit or a mere jot if his name was Theodore, Sam, or Pol Pot. A true Dave is a true Dave is a true Dave. And the name is starting to become my fave. There are certainly Daves who are shifty thieves, who are liars or have something up their sleeves. But a true Dave is something other than that. He's as iconic as the Cat in the Hat. And like a flower with any name smells sweet, a true Dave doesn't need a name to be neat.
All right, Dave.
All my friends are named Dave.
That was the first point of you, or Steve.
Or right. Steve, right.
Oh, it is a common one. It's amazing how common it is.
In the computer industry, there's something they call the Law of Daves. And that is at any technical conference, still be as many people there named Dave as there are women.
As many or more.
So I have, again, several different poems I could read. Any mood suggestions here?
What do you want?
Fantastic.
Yeah.
Fantastic. Okay.
Some of your sci-fi.
Some of my sci-fi.
Yeah.
I'm not prepared to read some of my sci-fi.
No, do you do sci-fi poetry?
Do I do sci-fi poetry? I think I do have something that might be considered sci-fi.
Like Star Trek?
No, sci-fi. No, like science fiction, actually, not sci-fi.
Is it sci-fi or time travel that your new thing is?
It's science fiction time travel, which means that it's about what a typical science fiction story would be about, is, you know, kind of the endeavors of humankind beyond the known and that kind of thing. But it is not hard science fiction. The technology is not the focus of the story. It's the being able to travel back in the past to a time where Eleanor of Aquitaine was the wife of two kings and the mother of two kings and the most powerful woman in Europe, that kind of thing. It's very much a love affair with the history and that kind of thing as well, is the time travel. It's called Superman's House. Mom always pointed it out. There at the top of the hill where Telegraph Road comes in, white with black shutters, Greek columns out front, always an American flag flying up on a white pole that sprouted straight up from a trim green lawn, was a two-story mansion 10 times as big as our yellow ranch house. That's Superman's house, she'd say. We looked with awe. We knew Superman. We saw him in our living room. He was big and strong and would leap into frame with his crew cut and a black and white and gray costume with matching cape. He saved Metropolis, Lois Lane, and Jimmy Olsen from big trouble every afternoon on our black and white console TV. Now, every time we reach the top of that hill on our way to the store or coming back from swimming at the quarry, we ask to stop in and say hello. But Mom always shook her head, no, not today. And we'd complain and chorus, why not? Yeah, why not? All the way down the hill to our little yellow ranch house. A few years later, we heard the truth. That big house at the top of the hill where Telegraph Road comes in was owned by ordinary but relatively wealthy folk who one night threw a costume party. It was the party to be seen at in Holly, New York in the late 1950s. And my parents attended. It would have been before we were born. At that party, some ordinary guy, walked in a Superman's costume. And ever after that, for several years, my mother joked that was Superman's house. It must have been one of the last parties she'd gone to, because soon she would be busy with four toddlers. And saying those words, Superman's house, must have given her back that moment of conviviality, of ease, when her hands were not so tied, and we listened and believed. Our belief had now met its kryptonite. It sailed like a caped hero up into the atmosphere, but like a balloon, spurred only on a gust of wise, it eventually popped. And the game of helping Mom relive that free, happy, innocent moment was over. And I guess we all grew up with it. The Rider in the Dog's Body. I have my coffee freshly I have my coffee freshly brewed with filtered water, and I write, long-handed and spidery, about the sea, the gall, the traffic, the seafood. It's early morning, and I am just waking. I have no idea what I just spent 30 minutes scrawling. My coffee is almost done. I hear my stomach growl, but I know I'm not yet hungry. And I hope he has not noticed. If he hears, he will set his computer aside, sweep up from his chair, and ask, time for breakfast? I am the writer. He is the dog's body. He is there for me. His only purpose is to support my writing. He makes the bed every morning. I drink the coffee. He brings me a snack of crackers and cheese in the afternoon and maps out where we might eat dinner. He washes and puts away the dishes. He sets up the bed every night. In between, he sits quietly in the corner reading or goes for a walk to give me space. And when he returns, he asks me, how's it going? When should I tell him I have writer's block?
Thank you very much.